Oftentimes, when followers of Jesus gather together, a leader will say, "Hey, where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am among them." They're talking about Jesus, which begs the question, well, where was Jesus before that? And is that actually what Jesus meant when Matthew recorded his words in Matthew chapter 18? Well, this is one of those passages that we need to unpack a lot of context to clearly understand what Jesus was saying. So this particular teaching is going to go a few minutes longer than what we normally do in order to ensure that we've tackled all of the context to clearly understood what Jesus said and how we can apply it well in our lives today. So part four, out of context, here we go.
Hey friends, welcome to the teaching series. We're so glad that you're listening. This podcast is the audio version of our highly visual video series that you can find on our website, walkingthetext.com, or on our YouTube channel at Walking the Text. You know, the Bible can be difficult to understand, and that confusion typically happens when we read the Bible without understanding its context. Well, that's why we create resources like this to help you understand the Bible in its original context, so that you can learn, love, and live it out every day. Brad Gray is our teacher for this episode today, and we know that with a growing understanding of biblical context, you'll be reading the Bible with greater clarity and confidence than ever before. So with that in mind, let's jump in.
Well, throughout this series, we have been looking at well-known passages that are routinely pulled from their context. And this passage from Matthew 18, 20, where two or three gather in my name, there am I with them, is like at the very top. As I mentioned in the opener, pastors, priests, worship leaders, small group study leaders will oftentimes begin by saying, "Hey, Jesus is among us, because as Jesus said, where two or three gather in my name, there I am among them." Now, there's nothing wrong with reminding people that they are in the presence of God. The problem comes when we quote passages thinking we know what they mean, and they actually don't mean what we think they mean. And so when it comes to a passage like this, we need to be reminded of just the general biblical narrative around God's presence. You've got famous passages like from David in Psalm 139, where it just talks about, where can I go from your presence? Because the biblical understanding is that God's presence is everywhere. Now, in Matthew 18, which is where our passage is today, we got to be reminded of what came before, because Jesus has already said in Matthew chapter 6 in the Sermon on the Mount, "But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen, and then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." So Jesus has already said, when it's just you and you are going to God in prayer, you are in the presence of God. So when leaders will say, "Hey, where two or three gather, Jesus is among us," and they use that as a way of saying, because we've gathered, we can be sure that Jesus is here, Jesus is already there. And so when we say this, we're basically saying to people, "Hey, you've got to gather together in community in order to experience the presence of Jesus." And that's not true. Now, community is a very important thing, and we're going to talk about that in this episode. But we have to be very careful when we talk about this in that kind of a context. What's more, this passage is often quoted in the midst of a church context, but the passage itself is in the context of church discipline. Now, some of you are like, "Okay, that just made me feel icky, and I am done with this teaching." Okay, don't leave the teaching yet. Hang with me for a couple of reasons. The first is this. At the very end of Matthew, Jesus says to his disciples, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you." So this is a teaching of Jesus that he commanded his disciples to pass on. We must wrestle with it. It is among the Jesus teachings. Secondly, we want to grow in our ability to rightly handle the word of truth. And the complexity of this passage will actually sharpen our skills to be able to engage God's word well. So with that in mind, let's be reminded that all throughout this series and all the teachings we do at Walking the Text have this framework as a backdrop. These are our lenses of context, and you can learn all about this in our free ebook at walkingthetext.com, the number one mistake most everyone makes reading the Bible. And it talks about how we're utilizing these six lenses of context. Now, specifically for this episode, it's the literary context that is going to reign supreme. Now, we're going to pull in some linguistics, some language connections, as well as some cultural pieces, but by and large, it's the literary aspect of how Matthew is recounting these stories that helps us to understand the context for our passage today. So let's jump into this literary flow, and I'm just going to start a couple of chapters back in Matthew chapter 16, because there are a number of connections to Matthew 16, and when Matthew has recorded all of these stories of Jesus, Matthew assumes you know what has come before, and you're not just jumping into a passage without any understanding of what's come before it. So Matthew chapter 16, we have this story where Jesus takes his disciples to Caesarea Philippi. And this is one of the most explosive passages in all of the Gospel of Matthew. And if you're interested in understanding more of what was going on in Caesarea Philippi, and specifically the interaction Jesus has with his disciples in Matthew chapter 16, check out this teaching at Walking the Text called Release to Receive. It's a longer teaching I did on the backdrop to this story. Now, just to summarize, though, at Caesarea Philippi, something happens for the very first time. Jesus overtly claims to be the Messiah. And then on the heels of that, he also does something for the very first time. He indicates that he must die. He's actually going to tell his disciples this three different times, but this is the first place it happens. And they're all wigged out, particularly Peter, who pulls Jesus aside, and Jesus then has to call him Satan because of the exchange that Peter has with Jesus. And then you have in Matthew chapter 17, you have the story of the transfiguration, which likely takes place at Mount Hermon, and the identity of Jesus as the Messiah is confirmed. And right on the heels of this, a second time now, Jesus says to his disciples, I've got to die. Again, this is just like, this is not the messianic understanding that the disciples had of what a Messiah was going to do. It's a very, very challenging time for them to wrestle with the implications. And so you have this in Matthew 16 and Matthew 17, and then you come to Matthew 18, and we're now in Capernaum, which is home base for Jesus' ministry, and the chapter begins with the disciples on the heels of Jesus having to say, I'm going to die multiple times. They're arguing about who's the greatest. Like, who's the greatest in the kingdom, Jesus? And I just wonder if there wasn't just these fleeting moments where Jesus was going, man, this whole human experience is so hard. Like, I've just told them I'm going to die, and they're arguing about who's the greatest. So let's just kind of pull in what's going on in Matthew 18. It begins with the disciples asking who's the greatest in the kingdom. And then Jesus grabs a child and he begins to tell his disciples that the greatest in his kingdom are those who have the humility of a child. And it's not just humility he's getting at, he's also talking about a heart of service. So he then starts talking to them about not causing anyone to stumble. It's about humility, it's also about service. It's recognizing that the decisions you make impact other people, so be very careful what you are doing that you don't cause someone else to stumble. And then Jesus goes a step further and he says, and when you see people stumbling, not because of you, but they're getting caught in sin and they're going astray, Jesus goes, in your humility and in your service, you need to go and pursue them. And he does this by telling a parable of the wandering sheep. Then we have our passage for this episode. And then it ends, chapter 18, with Jesus telling a parable of the unmerciful servant, which is really a parable about extravagant forgiveness. Because in the context of our passage, we're going to see someone has been wronged. Someone has wronged someone. And Jesus is going to say, when that happens, let's talk about the process that you need to adhere to. But then also remember that you've got to be a community that forgives people well, because you're going to hurt others and you are also going to be hurt by others in the community. So just knowing this allows us to jump into our passage, but I want to give you the very last verse of the parable of the wandering sheep that precedes our passage. Because again, there is a flow here. Jesus is in the midst of a teaching block, and all of these things are connected. So Jesus ends the parable by saying, in the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should perish. Okay, so God isn't wanting them to perish. So Jesus is going, now when someone's going astray, here's what you've got to do. So this is where we jump into our passage. If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have gained them. Now, quick note, I added this against you here because later manuscripts have this, and some of your translations actually have this in the text. Other translations do not have it, but they have it footnoted. And I want to just acknowledge the fact that this is not just about someone who sins against you. Jesus is saying, in the context of my community, if you are aware that someone has sinned, it's not been against you, but this is a sin that is causing a problem within the community, this is also part of your responsibility to go and address the person. Okay, so this is just something that, depending upon your translation, will either be footnoted or it'll actually be in the text itself, but that's a later set of manuscripts. The earliest ones don't have that. So Jesus is basically pointing out a process that you go through in order to confront someone in a healthy way. So just notice that you go and point out their fault just between the two of you. You don't post this on social media. You don't go and gossip to somebody else about the situation. You go directly to them. And the whole point is to gain them back. This is not to prove them wrong. This is not to shame them. This is about to gain them back. Step one. Step two. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along, so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And what this passage has done has already put in quotes to let you know that this quote right here is actually from the Hebrew Scriptures. And it's from Deuteronomy 19:15, which says, "One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime or offense they may have committed. On the testimony of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed." So this was originally in the context of anybody, you know, doing some kind of a crime. It's that there wouldn't be a false testimony. You had to have multiple witnesses. And this is what Jesus is drawing from here in Matthew 18:16, is that if you've gone to that individual and they have been obstinate and they don't want to comply, they don't want to resolve the conflict, they don't want to reconcile, Jesus goes, okay, grab somebody else and go to that person, and they get to serve as witnesses. They didn't witness what that person had originally done, but they're there to serve as objective witnesses to the process. And it's not to gang up on the person who has been in the wrong. In fact, those witnesses serve as objective parties to both sides of the conversation. Is the person who brought forth the issue to the offender handling it well? Is the offender actually in the wrong? Is this being handled in a healthy way? They're there to be a form of witnesses to the process. So again, and it's still a relatively private matter. Like, nobody else knows about what's going on. You're trying to get it resolved. And then that is step two. And if this doesn't go well, then Jesus says, if they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Now, this word church here is problematic, at least in the translation, because the word is ekklesia. And ekklesia is a word that means assembly, meeting, congregation, community, and only later is it the word for church. There is no church during this time. Jesus didn't come to start a new religion. Jesus came as a Jewish Messiah within the stream of the entire biblical narrative through the Jewish people to be the greatest expression of who Israel was longing to be and who they were looking for. And so when Jesus uses this word that gets translated as ekklesia, because Jesus is not teaching in Greek, it doesn't first and foremost mean church as in how we think of church. Now, fun fact, interesting connection, ekklesia is only used in the Gospels in two places, here in Matthew 18 and also in Matthew 16 with Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus is talking to Peter and he says, "And on this rock I will build my church." Again, a better word there would be to build my community. Now, Jesus says, if they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church or to the community or to the congregation. And recognize in Jesus's day, you're dealing with more of like synagogue communities, which are not like these massive communities of hundreds and thousands of people as many churches are today. We're talking about a smaller community. And the reason why Jesus is saying, take it to the community, is because Jesus is recognizing that whatever the sin is of this individual, it's going to impact the entire community. And if that person is going to impact the community negatively, then Jesus says, bring them before the community and try to resolve it that way. Now, some people, when they're looking at this, are saying this is not about a person standing up in front of hundreds of people and, you know, saying this is my sin, which has often been how it's been translated or understood, brought into a modern context. Some scholars actually believe that there would be a group of elders within the community that would basically serve as this quote-unquote church here, because again, the word ekklesia can mean a gathering or a community, and it could not be the entire community per se. It might be a select number of leaders who are able to arbitrate on behalf of the problem at hand. So there are challenges with how we understand Jesus's words as we drag them 2,000 years forward. But Jesus says, if they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Now, when he says, take it to the church, I love how Eric Bargerhuff just says, here is where everyone who has a relationship with the unrepentant can reach out to them in an attempt to win them back. This is where the church truly embraces what it means to be a forgiven and forgiving community. So again, it's not about shaming people. It's about winning them back. It's about gathering around them and saying, hey, we are in this with you. But then Jesus says, if they don't even want to listen to the community, then treat them as a pagan or a tax collector, which means to remove them from the community. They're not allowed to gather together. And Jesus is saying that because the sin of the individual is going to pollute the rest of the community. And this is a serious matter. And Jesus says, exclude them from the community. And the idea is not that they would always be excluded, but the hope would be is that them being excluded from the gathering, the community, would cause them to recognize the seriousness of what they have done and that they would want to reconcile so that they could join the community again. And then Jesus goes on and he says, truly I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And it's like, this is so weird for Jesus to then say this. What's up with this binding and loosing thing? Well, let me just make quick mention. This shows up in only two places in the Gospels, and you guessed it, here in Matthew 18 and in Matthew 16, when Jesus, speaking to Peter, says, I will give you the keys of the kingdom, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So once again, we have this connection to Matthew 16 and Caesarea Philippi. And I encourage you to check out that release to receive. But just in a summary statement, when Jesus takes the disciples to Caesarea Philippi, he takes them to a place of the convergence of evil in the land of Israel on multiple fronts. And what Jesus proclaims to his disciples is that my community needs to go after the chaos and the brokenness of the world. Okay, that's the whole point of Caesarea Philippi. And what Jesus recognizes is that the Jesus community must be united to confront the chaos of the world. and that the greatest threat to the church is not to what's on the outside, it's what's on the inside. It's the backstabbing, it's the gossip, it's the spreading of lies, it's believers not coming together in harmony and unity, and it fractures everything on the inside. And this is why I think this is such a huge connection to Caesarea Philippi to understand what's going on in Matthew 18. And so when Jesus talks about this idea of binding and loosing to Peter in Matthew 16 and now to the disciples as a whole in Matthew 18, the idea of binding and loosing is that when you are coming together to try to understand what to do, and there is no precedent from the Hebrew Scriptures, then you come together and you try to figure out, what do we prohibit and what do we permit? The word binding means to prohibit, loosing means to permit or to allow. And it's like when Jesus was speaking to Peter in Matthew chapter 16, he says, Peter, there are going to be challenging circumstances, and I'm giving you the keys to the kingdom. Whatever you bind and loose, God will affirm. Meaning, Peter, when you come together as a community and you have no precedent from the Scriptures and you have to make a decision and you're earnestly seeking me, God will affirm your decision in the midst of the community, which, by the way, is exactly what's happening in Acts 15 with the Jerusalem Council and what do you do with Gentiles. So just read that in that light. And here Jesus is saying, as the community comes together and binds and loose what to do in the midst of the disciplinary process, Jesus goes, God's going to affirm it. And that's why the very next words he says, again, truly I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything they ask for, talking about what to do in the midst of this difficult circumstance, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven, meaning God will affirm it. Because as the community came together to discern the will of God, God's going to disclose to them what they're supposed to do. And then Jesus affirms this with the well-known quoted passage, for where two or three gather in my name, there am I with them. Now, this is really unique because what Jesus is saying is that he is uniquely present in the difficult process of discernment. Now, here's why this is so fascinating is that in light of a larger cultural narrative recorded in the Mishnah and then later in the Babylonian Talmud, you have all of these passages about, like, Mishnah, Perkei Avot, the sayings of the fathers. When two sit together and words of Torah pass between them, the divine presence rests between them. So they're talking about that when two come together and they're talking about the study of Torah, it's like God's presence is uniquely there with them. Shortly thereafter in Perkei Avot, when three eat at one table and speak the words of Torah there, it is as though they have eaten from the table of God. Again, God's presence is uniquely there as they are gathering together around a meal and to also talk about Scripture. In the Babylonian Talmud, when three sit in judgment, i.e. as judges, the divine presence is within them. This is the idea that when two or three are gathering together, God's presence is uniquely there. And Jesus in this passage is saying, I am that presence that is there. Which would have been shocking to the disciples to hear because they understood this in light of God. And Jesus goes, no, I am that divine presence. I am there among you, and I will help you in this process. And as Michael J. Wilkins just says, Jesus assumes the place of the divine presence among his disciples, guaranteeing that when his followers have consensus, when asking in prayer for guidance in matters of discipline, his Father in heaven will guide them as they carry it out. And I would even just say, for all of us, that as we're wrestling with this, it's not just around this idea of discipline and every church community has to come together and understand how are we going to employ these words of Jesus. I think that there's a larger principle at play, which is that Jesus is uniquely present in the difficult process of discernment. That when we come together in the midst of a hard conversation, seeking the face of Jesus and trying to determine what to do, like Jesus is uniquely present in that moment. When we gather together with friends and we are seeking the face of God and we're trying to understand what do we do and we come together in prayer, it's like Jesus' presence is uniquely there guiding us on what to be praying and what to be doing. that when we have a hard decision to make and we've got to lock arms and figure out what is next, Jesus is uniquely there among us. It's not that when we talk to Jesus or ask for help that he's not there. He is. It's as if there's something about the community coming together to seek the face of Jesus, that his presence is uniquely there in that hard, difficult discernment process. And we have hope that Jesus is aware and is moving when we enter into these moments with a posture of humility, with a posture of seeking. Jesus promises to help us in that process. So big, bulky, a lot going on. But my hope is that as you work through the complexity of a passage like this, we come out the back end better understanding what Jesus meant in the first place and how we can walk these words out in our lives today. So friends, thanks so much for watching. Thanks for listening. And may we truly walk out this text well in our life.